if we create the most beautiful object, but in the process we pollute our environment, then do we still call that object beautiful? If we create something that does not seem very modern, but the type of engagement that has led to its creation in sustainability, the participation of the community, isn't that beautiful?
Hello, and welcome to How to Lead a Sustainable Business. I'm Alana Weston, and I believe that sustainability will be the next big disruptor of my industry. It has to be placed at the heart of business strategy if we're to address the climate crisis and transition to an economic model that is regenerative and just. The latest IPCC report demonstrates what we all know. There is no time left for incremental progress. Complete systems change is needed for us to grapple with the enormous challenges that face our planet and the people who live on it. I want to focus on the leaders who are driving that change. Throughout this series, I'm going to look at six different sectors where my guests are at the forefront of that reinvention. This week, I'm joined by Christian Benimana, Senior Principal and Managing Director of Mass Design Group in Rwanda. Christian studied architecture at Tongji University in Shanghai before returning to his native Rwanda. In 2014, he was appointed as Country Program Manager of Mass Design Group. And since 2019, he has been a director of the African Design Center. Boston-based Mass Design Group operates in 20 countries, principally across Africa. Its mission is to research, build, and advocate for architecture that promotes justice and human dignity. Mass believes that architecture has a critical role to play in supporting communities to confront history, shape new narratives, collectively heal, and project new possibilities for the future. In 2020, Mass Design Group was named Architecture Innovator of the Year by the Wall Street Journal, and in 2022, as the American Institute of Architects Architect of the Year. Welcome to the podcast, Christian.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Christian, you grew up in Rwanda, but took the unusual step of studying architecture in Shanghai. How has your perception of being an architect changed since you've come home to Kigali?
Quite dramatically, actually. The model of practicing architecture and design in China is based on the manufacturing capacity of that country and very much supports the type of creativity architects and engineers and designers are able to pull out because of those capabilities. When we are trying to do impactful projects on the continent, oftentimes we rely on the same manufacturing capacities and supply and logistics chain of other nations. Because of that, we tend to import a lot of what we do with buildings. And we have been trying to learn how to rely on available capacity in labor force and skill sets to be able to produce our buildings.
And in terms of what the purpose of architecture is, how have you started to think about that differently since you were a student?
The honest answer is I didn't think about it when I was a student. I started thinking about it when I started working here in Rwanda, because the firm that I was working with was very much born out of investigating this question. How can architecture serve more people and be done differently than relying on a select few number of potential clients that can afford architects?
I mean, it's a very unusual firm. For a start, it's a not-for-profit. And why did you join them? And can you tell me a bit about their culture as a business?
I was invited to join Mass because the person that I worked with at the School of Architecture, the first School of Architecture in the country, was heading Mass Design Group at that time. And the culture that I found there was one that tries to question everything around us in an effort to try to find a better way, or an alternative way, if I can call it that way, to be able to pull out more out of this architecture design processes.
And what do you personally believe is architecture's role as a force for good in society?
I think architecture, like any other trade or discipline, has the responsibility to help solve societal problems and improve our lives. I personally believe that everything we do as people should be meant to better society, and that we just happen to contribute to that quest using the trades or the technical capabilities that we happen to learn in schools.
I mean, food and shelter are pretty fundamental human needs. It seems to me that as we face the big challenges, getting those two right are going to make an enormous difference. Tell me a bit about your current projects and how you're addressing some of those problems. I mean, what's the starting point for developing a concept?
You stated it right. Food and shelter are fundamental to our being. We refer to it as the right to breathe. Basically, what that means is that we have to find ways where the spaces we inhabit or the physical space we create on this planet does not hinder our ability as individuals, as communities, and as a planet to breathe fresh air. Jumping into the second part of your question, how we start with the concept of a project, we begin by questioning what the mission is. We ask the partners that we work with what they're trying to achieve through their work. And then from there, we now work backwards to try to understand what is specifically that architecture can help support in their successes. And then from there, we can now start developing conceptual work that we believe is aligned with that mission.
It's important to ask those questions because often people just think, I want to build something, you know, whether it's a school or hospital or even a shop, they just say we must build it. And I think getting to the heart of the person who's actually going to use it is key, isn't it? Do you often work with multiple stakeholders for the projects that you work on?
I think that's one of those fundamental misunderstandings of the architecture and design industry, is that we oftentimes reduce that term client to the person or the entity that is cutting the check. It's much more complex. If we give an example of a school, when we listen only to the person cutting the check about the priorities of the school, and then we forget that the primary role of a school is to produce good learning outcomes for children. When we fixed on either meeting budgets or meeting deadlines or meeting certain aesthetic preferences, then we're having the wrong conversation. When you start from at least getting alignment on what you're seeking to achieve, which is better education outcomes, then you start understanding your students as not stakeholders in the project, but clients. The Minister of Education, the country you're working in, is not a stakeholder, is part of the client structure. We architects and designers have oftentimes shied away from being part of those conversations and only embracing the technical part of our work. We architects must be responsible for these other answers as well.
So talk to me a bit about beauty, because I do feel that architecture is changing in that for the last 20, 30 years and probably before, there's been a real emphasis on the building as an object that we should admire, that's visible from a long distance, that's shiny, that's glass, that's very technical. And I wonder if now people are coming back a little bit more to the function of the building for the individuals that are going to spend time there, as well as the impact that building has on climate, biodiversity, and all of these other things we're worried about. Since you've been in the field, what have you seen has changed? Or do you think in Africa, you're ahead of the game?
That's the century-old question, right? Does form follow function? function for the forum. And in our practice, we argued that it should not be either or, that we need to fight to change conditions that force us to choose between those two things. We believe that the creation of beauty is a necessity. Everybody, regardless of their origin, where they live, the resources they have, deserve a built environment that is beautiful and that is helping to improve their lives. So when you think about it that way, then you also must extend the definition of beauty beyond just aesthetics. If we create the most beautiful object, but in the process we pollute our environment, then do we still call that object beautiful? And if we create something that does not seem very modern, but the type of engagement that has led to its creation and sustainability, the participation of the community, isn't that beautiful?
I love that redefinition of beauty. I think that's very important and wise. Can you tell us a bit about a project that you've been working on recently where you found that sweet spot between form and function, between the various clients, between the outcomes for the building, having those stories running all the way through?
I can speak to the Ellen DeGeneres campus for the Diane Gorilla Fossey Fund. This is a project that we worked on with the Diane Gorilla Fossey Fund. It's a conservation organization that's worked tirelessly for the conservation of mountain gorillas in the north of Rwanda, southern Uganda, and eastern DRC. Quite literally saved the species that was going to be extinct very, very soon. When we started talking to them, they were looking for office space. That's what they thought their need was. But in having these conversations that we were talking about, we were able to come to the conclusion, both us and them, that what they do is that they're producing knowledge about these animals that we share 99% of DNA with. These inspirational stories need to be broadcast to create awareness about what it means to do that work and why we should care. The way the campus was designed to house different aspects of their work, have a gallery that people can visit and understand, and give them more space for them to do further research and have an education space. What started as an office space ended up being this campus that we're calling the gateway to conservation activism.
I love that idea of bringing all those clients together and making an exponential effect to the project beyond just what are offices. And anyway, we don't need offices anymore, do we? Because we all work from home. So, you know, we've got to develop buildings that can be so many more things. But what about carbon? How is Mass Design Group and how are you as an architect grappling with this? Embodied carbon seems to be the most difficult to address. But of course, as temperatures become more extreme, also the operational carbon is going to become more expensive and more harmful to the atmosphere. So what kind of approaches have you taken to solving this problem?
Well, we're doing a number of things, but one is to understand what type of organization we want to create first, because if we're not properly structured, we might break the organization trying to solve a problem we are not fit to solve it. So because of that, I think such decisions as, you know, being a not-for-profit, so we're able to raise philanthropy capital that allows us to run programs that don't get paid for by the markets, but are essential to making progress towards these goals. Number two is the processes of our work. In the processes of our work, we want to understand where we can plug in and be useful and where we can't or we don't. And as you just pointed out, the majority of the people in that space are focused on the operational carbon. And very few are interested in the embodied carbon. The major reason for that is because the embodied carbon generally tends to fall into the manufacturing industry that we kind of like consider outside of our industry. By disconnecting our work from that other industry we consider not to be our problem, but we benefit from, that we trust to give us products with a green label that says this is sustainable, go use it on our buildings, then we sometimes fail to question that green label on that product. We're not going to reach the global target set of halving our emissions by putting green labels on things that we've been using for the past 100 years. We actually need to fundamentally change how we do things. We are trying to work towards creating projects that can demonstrate that you can actually rethink the whole building and be able to achieve better results that give us a chance of hitting the targets we set.
And there's an enormous challenge, but also opportunity in Africa, because there's so much growth to come. It's the opportunity to get it right. And in Europe, we have to convert the existing building stock to something more regenerative and less wasteful, which is a slightly different problem. And I'm wondering, what do you think are the right conditions that are needed for that systems change in Africa so that growth will be both environmentally sustainable and socially inclusive?
From a nation building standpoint, there must be a resolve from the highest leadership possible. We have to invest in solving these problems unconventionally, not rely on the things we've done in the past because they haven't worked. Building the rest of the systems of the nations to support that innovation is critical. If the regulatory framework and the governance structures do not welcome innovation and unconventional way of solving for these problems, it's not going to happen. Number two is obviously young people and innovators and professionals have to be motivated and incentivized to utilize their creative power towards finding those solutions, not forced to fall within the lines of, you know, conventional wisdom and working, but like really be encouraged to take risks.
Just because something is innovative doesn't mean it has to be high tech. And sometimes I think that this is unconventional to think that technology might not save us. And actually, I think it's interesting to figure out what we could learn from the people who don't have all the education, who don't have the formalized instruction, but who have been building for hundreds of years in a certain landscape under certain conditions. What can architects learn from them?
There is this tendency for architecture and design to be elitist. We don't have the vocabulary to communicate with people who are not architects and designers. We talk amongst ourselves. We understand each other. Innovation is universal. What we need to do as architects and designers is to tap into that innovation and creativity around us. It's not that we should learn from these informal sectors. We should actually acknowledge that we learn from these sectors, and what we create comes from the world out there, not from our brains.
And I mean, when you look back or forward, what is the legacy of colonialism in Africa as far as the continent's architectural and construction aspirations? I mean, how can countries such as Rwanda move on from that legacy and invent truly African cities for the future?
I don't know. I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. But I think that the major challenge of that legacy has been what I refer to as the false ideals. We've set societal ideals that are incompatible with our environment, with our communities, with our people. Because colonialism basically created the idea that to be civilized, you need to live like Europeans or you need to live like Americans. And that's the biggest mistake we've done in Africa to try to be like Europe and all these other places that we consider developed and civilized. So how can Africa move from that? I think we'll have to go back to what the societal ideals, to what Africa-specific development looks like. Like, what is African urban living? And then once we define that, then we can create the cities that respond to African urban life living.
That makes sense. And I mean, you talked about elitism, and in the UK, certainly architecture is still very much a white male middle class profession. What are the challenges of building a diverse practice in a country like Rwanda?
There are many, they're challenging. The problem you point to is a legacy of our history and how academia and education in general has been for the past 100, 200 years. The challenge, as you say, is to run a practice long enough to cultivate that diverse talent. Because basically it means that the pipeline of talent we get right now is still very reflective of that legacy, still dominated by white male. But we're saying that to be equitable, we need to give also access to other minorities and the people in the field to be supported to progress faster than we have in the past. So, and again, because of that, we cannot rely on the conventional model of pipeline that are coming out of school and building practices off of that. We need to be unconventional. We need to run practices that have a business model that allows to not only cultivate that talent, but fast track them to become good architects. And then the other thing, of course, is to utilize the voice we have as practitioners to go back to academia and say, you know, we want to support you to do some of these fundamental changes from down there so that, you know, we eliminate barriers that will exclude some people from accessing this education that we badly need. Like, we have to be more than architects.
But being an architect is pretty hard. I mean, you've got to be a designer, a builder, but also a lawyer, a psychologist, and you've just added a whole list of other things. It's a huge pressure to manage so many clients, stakeholders, employees. I mean, what have you learned through your own experience about leadership in this space? And what advice do you have for young architects or just people who want to do things a little bit differently?
The biggest lesson I've learned is that it's easier to do all of these things, not as an architect, but as a person. Practicing architecture is what I do, is not what I am. I'm first and foremost a human being. And for me to participate to building my community, my society, I need to come from a place where I'm first and foremost thinking about these challenges as a member of this community and not as a professional, not an expert, not a demigod that has all the answers in their minds. And I think that changes things a little bit, because then it helps you understand that we are one piece of the big puzzle, and we need to understand what our exact shape is and where we fit within that puzzle. And we need to respect the other pieces of the puzzle, because without each other, we'll not be able to complete this task. At some point, we're going to have to change our shape. Maintaining that nimbleness and maintaining that flexibility, even though it's hard, unfortunately, it's what is required for success.
Christian, thank you for your thoughtfulness. And now for our quick fire round. So what's your definition of sustainability?
For me, it's balance. When the process and the outcome are both balanced in terms of ambitions and outcomes and actions and byproducts, and it can be justified, then it's sustainable.
Is there such thing as sustainable growth?
Yes, there is. And there should only be sustainable growth. Everything else should not be part of what we do or invest in.
And what's most important, consumer demand, legislation, or innovation?
All three equally.
And if you were a world leader, what would be the first three things you do for the planet or for a fairer society?
I'll change the global economic model. I think it's one thing that is set up to favor some and disenfranchise others.
And what is your call to action for listeners?
My call for actions is to be brave and do whatever we can to change things that we don't agree with around us.
And if you could reinvent one thing to halt climate change, what would it be?
Consumerism culture.
Christian Benimana, thank you so much for coming on to How to Lead a Sustainable Business.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please do take a moment to subscribe and rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. This lets us know what you think and helps others to find the show. This episode was brought to you by Selfridges Group and Intelligence Squared. The producer was Redzi Bernard, with technical assistance from Mark Roberts. I'm Alana Weston, and this is How to Lead a Sustainable Business.